Welcome to Wednesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a bit later in today's show, Prairie Plates visits with Chef Lauren Zoback of Fargo's 701 Eateries, and the discussion turns to comfort food, community, and creativity in hot dish and heart. Plus, Prairie Beat discusses the state's next state superintendent of public instruction. Governor Kelly Armstrong has appointed West Fargo School District's business manager, Levi Backmeyer, to serve in the role. She's a valley girl, and they're just
so girl. Like, my mother's like a total space cadet. She, like, makes me do the dishes and clean the cat box. I am sure that's, like, gross.
Main Street begins today with a note that this week, Bismarck State College invites us to press rewind on one of the most unforgettable decades in modern history, the Humanities Mixtape. Rewinding the 1980s Symposium runs today through Friday, and it brings together authors, musicians, and scholars to explore cultural currents of the era, from farm crisis to film icons, from Valley Girl slang to Cold War fears. Joining us is Michael Tomonic, Associate Professor of English at Bismarck State College and Project Director for Bringing Humanities to Life, and Allison Czar, the Program Manager for Continuing Education and Train ND at Bismarck State College. To both of you, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, I'm pleased that you are with us. Michael, let me begin with you. Let's start with the big picture. What is the Humanities Symposium, and how did this year's theme, how did that come about?
Well, basically, Bringing Humanities to Life is a program up at BSC that was established through the National Endowment of the Humanities, as well as a contribution from the Frank Babendick family through the BSC Foundation. And with that program, we have an annual budget to bring humanities programming of all sorts to the Bismarck-Mandan area and BSC. And basically, we just wanted to find a way, a creative outlet to bring writers and scholars to Bismarck for our students, for our community. And going off of BSC's history of symposiums that started in the late aughts Dr. President Scogin's time here on campus, with a history of numerous symposia, we wanted to kind of pick up from there and go forward kind of in our new way while still paying kind of homage to that original tradition.
So why the 1980s?
Well, one of the symposiums going back to about 2015 was on the 1960s. And it really felt that now was the time for the 1980s. Not only just sequentially coming 10 years after the symposium on the 1960s, but also that the 1980s seemed to be coming back in so many recognizable ways, whether it's the recreating of movies like Spaceballs Beetlejuice, pop culture like Stranger Things celebrating the 1980s, but then the way that it's also coming back in, whether it's through music or even in literature. We just can't get away from the 1980s, and I want to kind of explore, is that a good thing? Or did the 80s get it wrong?
I think the Humanities Mixtape is a playful title and perfect, right? You can include a lot of different things on a mixtape. Plus, it sure represents the era. What was your plan for that name? How did that come about?
Well, we wanted to have speakers and sessions that focused on topics related to the 1980s, but we also, we're a humanities program, so we wanted to interact with as many disciplines as we are able to do that take place throughout the humanities. So we, rather than just focusing on history or some other discipline, we wanted to have a mixtape and really put together a lineup that works together, but at the same time, independent hits.
Allison, your role is kind of the logistics, the planning and the execution. How is it coming together for you? And what have you been up to? And what are you up to now?
Sure. A big part of what we do is just implementing the ideas that Michael has put together. So it all starts with the speakers. We have primarily been working on making sure the speakers have what they need, making sure that their honorarium's in place, that their travel is good to go. We got the question yesterday, how do I get to from the airport to Bismarck State College? So trying to find somebody to transport some of those speakers and making sure they have their hotel rooms, as well as some of the fun stuff, like sending Michael ideas like, hey, what do you think about putting this? And we get to use BSC's new Advanced Technical Center. And the foyer is pretty amazing. So just lots of space to play with ideas and that. So making sure that those things get here. We have some cool signs to set up around the foyer, one for each year of the 80s, from 1980, of course, to 1989, with important historical events. So just different things like that. So we'll work on stuffing bags, and we got the programs yesterday and all kinds of things like that.
Is there still an opportunity for people to participate if they haven't had notice about this, I guess, previously?
We will have somebody on site tomorrow morning that can take registration over here in the Advanced Technical Center as well. The only thing is, if you don't want to register online, you can call our office at 701-224-5600, and Sarah will be happy to help you.
So, Michael, the agenda includes everything from farm policy to pop culture, photography, and film. How did your planning team come up with the tracks, if you will, to include in the mixtape?
Well, it came from a wish list of, it would be really cool if I could get this person, I really want to get this other person. But I even sat down with President Scogan at the start of the summer to just kind of brainstorm some of the ideas that really would try to pin down or represent the 1980s in multiple ways. So part of it was creating a symposium that I myself want to go to, but also finding topics that are relevant and connected to publications and writers who are currently or have in the past addressed these issues.
Was there a goal to make this more academically focused, cultural focused, humanities focused, a blend of all of this?
I really wanted a blend. I wanted the pop culture people like Chuck Klosterman, but I also wanted the perhaps, not to say that Klosterman isn't a serious topic by any means, but like Lisa Napoli, who wrote multiple books, including one on the founding mothers of NPR, as well as one on the Ted Turner's creation of CNN and the 24-hour news cycle. And I just wanted to kind of pick and choose and see what I could get and who would be interesting for the wide variety of audience members that we're going to have in attendance.
Let's walk through some of the speakers. Tomorrow morning opens with an interview featuring Dan Gladden and author Brad Baljukian. How did that pairing come together, and what do they represent about 80s culture?
Brad was one of the first people that I contracted with going back to January. And he has written a couple different books that connect back to 1980s pop culture and nostalgia. One is called The Wax Pack, which is all about kind of collecting baseball cards and kind of the America's nostalgia for baseball in general. And then he also wrote a book called The Six Pack, which is about professional wrestling and kind of a comparison of where the actor in kayfabe, as well as the actual individual, kind of begin and end. Like, where does the character, where is that line? And because it's often so gray. So, our intentions with reaching out to Brad was the Wax Pack, because it just seemed like, 1987 baseball cards just skyrocketed. And if you watch like Ken Burns baseball documentaries, the 1980s was in and of itself a decade very notable in the sport for positive and negative reasons. And then as far as Dan Gladden, he was one of the last people that we added to the list. And the 1987 World Series Twins, I was 12 years old when that happened. And I remember it fondly, and being a local person, from my childhood. I mean, it was so much a part of our region and in that time that I just had to see what I could get, and I got Dan.
Enjoying our conversation with Michael Timonik. He's an associate professor of English at Bismarck State College, and also Allison Czar. She's a program manager for continuing ed and train ND at Bismarck State College. And we are talking about a symposium that really gets in gear tomorrow through Friday at Bismarck State College, all about the 1980s. All right, let's march on, Michael, if we could, with some of the folks who are speaking. Sarah Vogel's talk on lessons from the farm crisis really adds a strong North Dakota connection in my mind. What conversations do you hope she brings to attendees?
Well, based on our previous conversations, Sarah's going to be talking about the agriculture crisis of 1980, but also that it's seemingly a cyclical thing that takes place, that took place in the past in the 1930s and is set to come back in the not too distant future, based on some of the evidence that's coming out. So she's really going to be talking about how that agricultural crisis in the 80s is a reflection of the past and the future. But she's also going to be helping set up the panel that follows that, which is going to be with Gordon on the Gordon Call case from that began in 1983, that when that shootout north of Medina took place in February 13th.
How important is it that you revisit that story within the context of the symposium?
You know, it was one of the historical stories, incidents that I really wanted to include because I remember it as a child, and I know my memory of it is a little, I mean, it's the memory of a child. And as I've aged and started to understand that case a little bit more closely and some of the nuances with it, it's something that, for as tragic and horrible as it was, I think North Dakota needs to remember this and not forget what happened that Sunday evening and what resulted of that, because, I mean, it was a byproduct of many things, but absolutely the agricultural crisis was created a breeding ground for a lot of Call's hate.
That'll be a very interesting panel discussion. Later, our own Dave Thompson, our news director here at Prairie Public, will explore the birth of the 24-hour news cycle. He was here during the time that you were talking about, and he's still with us today. How does the discussion resonate in today's world of nonstop news? We all have our phones. We know everything almost the instant that it happens. And of course, that wasn't the case back in the 80s.
Dave Thompson is going to be speaking really, I mean, kind of about his 40 years in the newsroom at Prairie Public, but also really how public radio came about and what was going on in the media in that time period up kind of right before the 1980s. And that's where that conversation with Lisa Napoli is going to take place, kind of as a segue between his presentation on public radio and her presentation on the 24-hour news cycle, and how those two media sources are a lot more connected than they seem today, because one seems to be driven by commercialism and the need to make money, where the other one, I mean, Prairie Public, I mean, for instance, it doesn't have those same kind of aims. Yes, there's, of course, the business model, but it's different than what we see on 24-hour television.
Later, a little bit on the lighter side, an exposition called The Photo of Life Before the 80s. What does that visual perspective add to the experience, or what are you hoping that it will add?
Well, so it might seem a little cheeky, but we invited Shane Balkowicz, the wet plate photographer, to attend, to participate and deliver a presentation on photography. But rather than the 1980s, we're going back to the 1880s, which were the kind of the last hurrah, at least in the original timeline, of wet plate photography, which was replaced by paper film by the end of that decade. And when I was talking with Shane, as we were coming to terms to get him to participate. We see a similar thing happening in the 1980s with, I mean, I remember as a child, again, Polaroids making way to regular film, I sitting in my grandma and grandpa's basement watching slide projector shows. All of that was replaced throughout the 80s. And once the slides went away, the film books came out. But soon enough, those were replaced too. With digital photography, and then AI now compromising that even further. So Shane's going to be giving us kind of this overview retrospective of film and through his own craft and how he brings that back. And my argument is that print media and physical media are going to make their way back. I think AI is going to force us to start reading more published, edited material.
I dearly miss a morning newspaper on my doorstep. I just don't feel the same reading it online. And I've talked about that before. Friday sessions. Let's move into Friday now. We move into language, nostalgia, and the Cold War's influence on art and culture. How do you see those sessions kind of leading into the event's larger message?
In a sense, too, with those five presentations on Friday morning, aside from the interview with Usman Malik, the other four are more academic style presentations, and many of them connect with popular culture, whether it's through Kevin Moberg's presentation on Valley Girl Speak or the apocalyptic imagery with Holly McBee's presentation, or even Gen X in the 1980s with Melissa Vosin-Callens and Adam Tima's on cyber culture. All of these things have their roots in popular culture, but also have a lot of practical influence on where we've gone since then, whether it's science fiction inventing things that actually have come to life or just the way the last 40 some years has played out. So connecting to those themes of popular culture, but also not only how the 80s really shaped us, but also, well, they shaped us technologically, but also culturally.
I think you have a remarkable closing lineup. The one I'm most fearful to listen to is Chuck Klosterman's talk about the future has been canceled. A little bit about that, but how did you design those sessions to kind of wrap up the conference?
Well, I wanted to end with both Chuck Klosterman as well as Deborah Marquardt. I mean, to me, they're two of North Dakota's most currently, as well as historically significant writers. I mean, Louise Erdrich is probably the one name above them, if it has to be above. But Chuck and Deborah are phenomenal writers, and I think they really bring a draw to Friday afternoon. I mean, not only the name recognition, but I mean, they're just wonderful people to read, and I'm excited to be able to listen to them. I'm excited to be able to be in the same room as them back to back. I mean, it was too good to give up and not try to make it happen. And then to start that afternoon with a partnership from Humanities North Dakota and bringing Becky Stone, a Chautauqua performer of Maya Angelou, the whole thing is going to be fun, but after that Friday afternoon is going to end on as high as a note as we can make it.
I want to ask each of you, and Allison, let me turn to you and I'll ask you first. Beyond nostalgia, what are you hoping that participants will take away from the 80s?
You know, a big part of it is we do have quite a few students that have registered to attend either part or whole parts of the symposium. And I think the students that we have on the BSC campus today, you know, they weren't born in the 80s, most of them. So I think just a reflection of how different life was during that time period, how there were all of these things, like before the 80s, like you mentioned, that we didn't have the 24-hour news cycle. You know, you had to wait until that time period, certain time of day to see what was going on in the world. You didn't have access to the internet. So it's just really hoping that it'll impact them and show them how different it was. And for those of us that were old enough in the 80s, just a reflection on how things really have changed and how, although they were tough, maybe they weren't as bad as we thought they were.
Michael? beyond nostalgia, what do you hope participants will take away from the 80s and maybe how it's impacted how we're shaped here today, socially, politically, and even technologically?
Aside from the nostalgia and the popular culture, kind of building on what Allison was saying, really just we're seeing it come back in a lot of ways and understanding that this, a lot of these trends and a lot of these issues happened before. They're not unique to now. They're not unique to then. And to allow our older participants to perhaps fondly remember, not only through nostalgia, but also through a more critical lens. But like Allison was saying, just really an educational opportunity to show our students that what happened before what happened before comes back, whether it influences us with physical, tangible things or just even ideas and culture.
History has a way of repeating itself.
That's what they say.
Allison, for those that really still want to take advantage of this, are there fees? Exactly what should they do if they want to learn more, if they want to make sure that they can get to campus to experience this event tomorrow and Friday?
Sure. Yes, there is a registration fee for the event. Participants have a couple of options. They can attend the full symposium for $49, which it does include a light breakfast and then also lunch, as well as something we haven't really touched on is tonight we're going to kick off with Beetlejuice. So they're welcome to join us for a pizza party tonight. Tomorrow night, we'll also have a showing of The Terminator, and then we'll have a social before that as well. Or if they just choose to attend Friday, if they just want to come and see Deb Moorcourt and Chuck Klosterman, they can choose Friday for $25. Also, if they're all members at BSC, there is a discounted registration for those individuals.
What kind of audience have you attracted? You mentioned earlier that you've had some students who have registered. Who else has registered?
I actually think a lot of them are the registrations that we have are either BSC alumni or members of, we have the Osher Lifelong Learning Program here at BSC for participants who are 50 or better. And so we have a lot of those individuals too who are looking to reflect back on the 80s.
As we wrap up the conversation, Allison, what are you looking forward to the most?
I was a history major in college, so all of this is right up my alley. So I'm just interested in, you know, meeting the speakers. Brad Belajukian is probably at the top of my list because I'm also a very big baseball fan. So looking forward to them.
Michael, how about you? You have a chance to kind of represent the entire program. Is there any one or two sections of the program that you're really excited about?
I'm really excited for it all, and I know that's cliche, but I mean, in addition to getting to hear the speakers who are more new to me, I'm really looking forward to Friday afternoon. But I'm also, I'm looking forward to each half day for the different reasons. And I just want to see a good symposium take place for a good crowd.
The three-day event runs October 22nd today through the 24th at the Bismarck State College Advanced Technology Center in Bismarck. Conversations, films, panels, performances, and social experiences exploring how one unforgettable decade still shapes our culture. Today, registration, as we learned, is still open, and you're welcome to visit bismarckstatecollege.edu/continuingeducation. Is that correct, Allison?
Yes, or if you just go to bismarckstate.edu and you search for symposium up in the upper search bar, that's probably the easiest way to find the website.
We've been pleased to be joined with Allison Czar. She's the program manager for continuing education and training ND at Bismarck State College, and Michael Tomonic, the associate professor of English at Bismarck State College and also the project director for Bringing Humanities to Life. To both of you, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street. Best wishes for a successful symposium.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you very much.
My mother makes me do the dishes. It's like so gross. Like all the stuff like sticks to the plate. And it's like somebody else's food. You know, it's like grody, grody to the max. I'm sure it's like really nauseating. Like barf out, gag me with a spoon. Gross. I am sure. Totally.
Still to come on Main Street, Prairie Plates with the comfort food of the season, hot dish. And Prairie Beat discusses the state's new state superintendent of public instruction. That's still ahead on Main Street, right after this news.
I like bagels.
Some barbecue,
applesauce, and some nice red beets.
You're listening to Prairie Plates here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public, served up weekly. And this week we have another special guest, Lauren Zoback from 701 Eateries, which is two restaurants actually. One is called Prairie Kitchen, and that's kind of the upscale lower level or main level. And then upstairs is Camp Lone Tree, which is a little more relaxed, a little more of a upper Midwest vibe, burgers and fries.
A little casual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, nachos, that sort of thing. Lauren, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Lauren, tell us a little bit about what you do at 701 Eateries, because you work in the restaurants, but I think you also do some stuff on the catering side.
I do. I was originally brought in to help kind of bolster the catering. We actually just had a fabulous event on Friday at Bear Creek Winery to launch the Midwest Mediterranean 2.0 cookbook that 701 sponsored, because Shelby, one of our owners, was actually one of the authors. She's an oncologist here in town.
Ah.
But, yeah, I laugh because we do have two restaurants. It's Prairie Kitchen downstairs. Upstairs is Camp Lone Tree, which is a little more casual, burgers, fries, potato olies, not olays, not to be confused with Taco John's.
We're getting a Taco John's back in Fargo.
I heard rumors. I'll believe it when I see it. And incidentally, Camp Lone Tree, because it's now getting colder, we've got some igloos built up there. We're doing more of a Thursday through the weekend, just because not everybody wants to be outside when these cold months are coming.
And speaking of that, the point of today's segment is to talk about hot dish. And I did have some chicken and wild rice hot dish at 701 last Saturday, which was very good. But first, I want to ask you a little bit about your background, because you're not from North Dakota.
I am not from North Dakota. I grew up on the West Coast. And so for me, I know this is going to be like a gasping moment, but for me, it's a casserole. It'll always be a casserole. It's been explained to me by the locals in the 5 years that I've lived here that a hot dish generally has a protein and will stand on its own, whereas a casserole is nothing more than a side. And for me, when it goes in a casserole dish, I've been indoctrinated. It's a hot dish. But and I laugh because my roommate who works at the Y, frequently we're on meal trains for people, and I don't want to give away this secret because I don't want to make it hard to find them anymore, but it's such a good one that anytime I'm on a meal train for that, I go and thrift hot dishes, because then I can just give somebody the whole thing, a casserole dish, a Pyrex dish, whatever, and I don't have to chase them down for it. And it's paying it forward. It keeps that aluminum that's always pretty wobbly and not great for serving in, out of a landfill. And then it's like pay it forward. It's about the same cost generally. So I hope this doesn't make everybody go to all the thrift stores and now I won't be able to find them anymore. But as Thanksgiving's coming, I've started stockpiling them when I'm thrifting.
Well, I think good examples would be green bean casserole for Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. which is a side dish, and then the ultimate, which is tater tot hot dish.
Yes.
In my opinion.
I have made a couple now since I've lived here while I've participated in meal trains.
And do you get the tater tots really nice? Like Molly Yeh, she's been on this program a few times and she would explain a hot dish as protein, vegetable, sauce, and then it would be baked or cooked for a while, mm-hmm. and it would be a main dish.
Yes.
So that would be accurate.
Yeah, like a pot pie.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's got some sort of starch in it.
Starch, too. Yes.
And I've made a couple. The one we make at 701 has what we were at 701. We strive to try and be as gluten free as possible. And we're striving to use as much local as possible. So that has local wild rice. And it kind of varies week to week, depending on how much spinach I have or kale I have. It always has a dark leafy green in it. Some sort of vegetable, whether it be a mushroom or some cauliflower or whatnot. Most of those things are what we have in the walk-in. So it's really like, oh, we're kind of low on spinach. That's okay. Let's add some extra mushrooms. And I think that's the beauty of a hot dish, is it's kind of a catch-all, like a quiche or an egg bake.
Speaking of egg bake, Yes. The ultimate egg bake to me was at Burn Bombs, and you had some of that same philosophy there where you'd use some of the vegetable scraps. Sometimes there were beets in there in that egg bake. But can you talk about your experience at Burn Bombs?
Everybody misses Burn Bombs. Yeah. I think Burn Bombs was super special. Working for Andrea, I think, is probably what kept me here. When I moved here back in 2000 during COVID, it was because of COVID. And the reason I applied at Burn Bombs was one of three restaurants I applied to when I got here. And one of the reasons I applied there, never mind the fact that it was a scratch kitchen and Andrea was so renowned, was the fact that everybody there was taking COVID seriously. My first year there, I was cooking on a line with a mask on, which, while you wear glasses, is not exactly ideal. But that was what drew me there. And I think that's what kept me there was the fact that it was such a scratch kitchen. It was so food forward, so farmer forward. I mean, she and I laughed when it was my turn to do a dinner, because we would, as the cooks, she would allow us to rotate, and Candace did a native dinner and Edward did a Latin dinner and Summer did one that was more pub food. When I did one, it was March, because it was International Women's Month, and I leaned into all the women in my life that had inspired me to cook. And each of the dishes I did were inspired by, like, just women and sense memory, because to me, I think food is all about sense memory. It drives me nuts when people ask me, what's your favorite thing or what's the best bite of food you've ever had? My standard answer to that, because I've been cooking as long as I've been cooking and I've done fine dining, is I couldn't tell you what that bite was, but it was probably in the middle of service. It was a single bite, and I ate it either sitting on a milk crate or over a garbage can because it was between tickets. That said, a perfectly toasted English muffin with some peanut butter and honey, I can close my eyes, and I am 5 years old with my feet dangling, sitting on a phone book at the dining room table at my grandparents' house.
Those simple things can be the best.
I think, and I think that's so much of why Burn Bombs was so special, because although we turned some things on their head, a lot of it was comfort food. I mean, just the amount of matzo ball soup we sold, I think, is a sign of that.
I think I had some what could be considered hot dish there a few times, moussaka, or some people would say moussaka, and it was delicious. Any other dishes you can think of there that were
that were special and lovely that people miss? I personally miss the bagels, and I may or may not have some starter in my refrigerator, but I think everybody in town misses the bagels. I think that what was so special about that place is it wasn't just the food, it was the atmosphere. I mean, the food spoke for itself, but I think it was just the fact that it was the welcoming atmosphere of the place in its entirety. And I laugh because I had applied at two other restaurants, and I got a call back on Indeed from that one in 45 minutes on the day that I applied. And Andrea knew who my mentor was by reputation, because what most people don't realize is that she went to culinary school in San Francisco. So we had although she's 10 years older than me, we had some similar chefs that we knew, which was kind of cool.
Well, Burn Bombs was definitely a special place. It's very welcoming there as well. Are there any special dishes at 701 that you can talk about?
I mean, I love our hot dish. I love our stroganoff, and I say this now I'm going to have to make it again all week. Our stroganoff sauce is dear to my heart. That was one of the things I was tasked with kind of tweaking and improving when I got there, and I think it's so well dialed in right now. I think it hits all the notes. I've also brought there, I'm slowly bringing some pastries there, because what a lot of people don't realize is I spent 8 years as a pastry chef. So one of the dishes I'm doing right now that's also gluten-free is a salted butterscotch pot au creme that followed me to three different restaurants throughout my career in my 20s.
I did happen to try that
on
Friday. Did
you? Good. I told Avalon to send you one. I was like, just put it on my shift meal. Rick should try one of those.
Delicious.
Thank you. I'm so glad. That thing followed me to, there was one restaurant I worked at in Pacifica where I would make that 90 at a time, because that's how much it sold. Granted, it was a very large restaurant, so we had more seats to fill and our volume was bigger, but I made those things like 90 to 100 at a time.
Now, another thing you gave me a sample of was a piece of cake that had some beans in it.
Yes, because, you tried the white bean blondies.
Yes. And you do some things, well, a lot of things, videos with the North Harvest Bean Growers Association. and have some videos out. Where can they find those?
Those are on the North Harvest Bean Growers YouTube page. Yeah. And I believe there are links all over their website for it. That just sort of fell in my lap also. That's my side hustle, is I have been the last year and a half or so developing recipes using the beans grown by the North Harvest Bean Growers Association. What most people don't realize, and I'm way too educated about this now, is 80% or so of the beans consumed globally grown right here in the Red River Valley, which is pretty cool. I mean, and that's one of the reasons our menu for the Midwest Mediterranean diet, the launch on Friday, we leaned into legumes for that too, because I was trying to do as much local as possible, because the entirety and the thesis of those books is that we grow all these things here and we should be eating the things that we grow in our backyard. If it grows together, it goes together. So I did a bunch of beans at that dinner. I did some local millet that came from Doubting Thomas at that dinner. We did some beautiful squash that also came from Noreen. So I've been able to meet, since I've been here in the last 5 years, some really, really wonderful farmers. And that's been fantastic.
That's Noreen Thomas with mm-hmm. Doubting Thomas Farms
yes.
by Cragness, Minnesota, who I need to have on this program. Now, getting back
yes.
to beans, I watched you make soup on these videos, minestrone and kale white bean mm-hmm. creamy soup, which I wanted to eat right away. But I was a judge for a chili competition on Sunday that was just a lot of fun, and it was a benefit for kids that can't afford music lessons. Mm-hmm. And so it just really felt great.
Stacy
about
School.
It. Yes.
Yes.
But all of the chilies were really good. But one thing, I don't like kidney beans and chili. I like other beans. Are there some beans that you would add to chili that you would recommend?
We actually made this weekend at 701 that we'll have the next couple days is a bison chili that does have some small red beans that are also local to here. So they're just the little guys. I'm with you. I feel like kidney beans are delicious. They belong in vegetarian chili when it's super bean forward, because I don't love a ton of beans in my chili.
And I don't even like them in vegetarian chili.
Really? And when Dr. B would make chili at Burn Bombs, he used white beans and red beans, but yeah. not always kidney beans.
Yep.
Sometimes pintos. It was really kind of also whatever beans we had, and generally those also came from Noreen.
Well, Lauren Zobach, great to have you in here. We'll have you back. Keep cooking.
Thank you. You're one
of the most talented chefs in the area. So.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And next week, we will have a haunted restaurant story. We'll see you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans. The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 2, Music from Within, with works by Mozart, Stravinsky, and Bloch, and performance by Maestro Christopher Zimmerman on piano, and principal flute Deb Harris. November 8th and 9th at NDSU Festival Concert Hall. Details at fmsymphony.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Parents of kids in North Dakota public schools want to know, who's the person who's going to replace former superintendent of public instruction, Kirsten Basler? This week we found out. Here's more from our regional podcast, Prairie Beat.
The person we are picking, who is Levi Bachmeyer, which I'm just going to say is a North Dakota native and a product of our K-12 public school system. He graduated from West Fargo. He likes to call it Best Fargo, which is cheesy and funny at the same time.
Hey, I'm Merrick Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We're back once again for another episode of Prairie Beat,
our weekly discussion of North Dakota news. And Danielle, here we now have a new state school superintendent.
Well, almost. So yes, somebody has been named to the office that will soon be vacated by Kirsten Basler. Basler has been superintendent of public instruction since first being elected back in 2012. And now she's headed to Washington, D.C. President Trump has nominated her to a position in the federal department Department of Education. And long story short, the Senate recently confirmed her to that position. She will serve as Assistant Secretary for Elementary and Secondary Education.
But I find that so interesting, so fascinating, considering the Trump administration has promised to end the Department of Education and has made a lot of moves in that direction. So there's not even any real knowing how long Kirsten Baszler will even work in that job. Even still, now she's been confirmed, but she's not getting to work just yet, is she?
No. So last week, we talked about the federal government shutdown. And then this week, that is still ongoing. And it's still causing a lot of issues, including this one. Baszler can't resign, and she can't get to work until she's sworn in. And she can't get sworn in until the government reopens.
Yep. She'll just have to wait to put that nameplate on her office door for a little while longer. So I guess that's why the new superintendent has yet to step into that role. But okay, let's hear it. The new guy out of West Fargo, what's he all about? Inquiring parents want to know.
Governor Kelly Armstrong has appointed Levi Bachmeier to the office. He was born and raised in North Dakota, graduated from West Fargo, and went to college in Concordia. He taught social studies for 2 years with Teach for America, and he also spent a summer as a policy analyst fellow at the U.S. Department of Education. And as Governor Armstrong told reporters at the announcement on Tuesday, you've probably seen him around Bismarck.
He's no stranger to the inner workings of North Dakota state government, having spent 3 years as Governor Burgum's education policy advisor and later policy director. He returned home to West Fargo in 2019, serving as the school's district's business manager since then. Your next superintendent of public instruction, Levi Bachmeier.
He's also been working as the track and field coach at West Fargo High School, so he's been around the education realm in various capacities for a while, in addition to working in various government roles.
Well, alrighty then, that is the guy. Now, the superintendent's position has been pretty highly sought after the last few election cycles. I can remember some of the candidates, but this was not someone who ran for the office before.
No. So our very own Dave Thompson recently spoke to Nick Archuleta. He's president of North Dakota United, the union that represents North Dakota teachers. And Dave asked him what sort of person he hoped would get chosen for the job.
Somebody who has a background in public education, has actually worked in a classroom, has actually faced some of the same challenges that teachers face every day.
Well, it certainly sounds like someone who checks a lot of those boxes.
When Bachmeier assumes this position, he will also be resigning from a few boards he's currently on, the Board of Public School Education, Career and Technical Education Board, as well as the State Board of Higher Education.
Yeah, wow. Sounds like he's certainly been a pretty busy guy with his finger on the pulse of education in the state of North Dakota. And with that experience, what does he perceive as his biggest challenge that he'll face in this new role?
Dave was actually at the news conference where Bachmeier was named superintendent, and he asked that very question. Bachmeier had this to say.
Education policy, like so many forms of politics today, has gotten tribal, where you either think that our schools are failing or that they're perfect and they can't be better. And I guess I would just want parents to know that I think our schools here are great, but with common sense, hard work, and high expectations, I think they can be even better.
Another thing he said in the news conference was that he is proud to be a product of North Dakota's very own public education system, and he's confident it can be made even better than it already is. Something North Dakota United's Nick Archuleta also said with that interview he did with Dave was that he hoped the next superintendent would continue to advance a lot of the same initiatives Kirsten Baszler worked on. And it kind of sounds like Bachmeier is interested in that angle.
I intend to build upon the great work that Superintendent Baszler has done in her time here leading DPI, and I'm really actually excited to hit the road. A great piece of advice that I heard from a former football coach who's now a legislator is you have to listen to learn to lead. And so I intend to be spending a lot of my time in the truck, visiting as many of our 168 school districts as I can reach.
Well, you know, considering, Danielle, some of the people who ran for state superintendent in the past who had pretty extreme positions on education and in culture war type issues, this guy seems like he's more in the mold of Kirsten Baszler, kind of a middle-of-the-road person that doesn't take those kind of extreme positions. For parents who are concerned about that and where the department is going in the future, does this guy kind of assuage some of those fears?
I would think so. Kelly Armstrong is not somebody I perceive that would pick somebody to hold those more extreme, maybe polarizing positions.
When will Bachmeier himself have to actually run for office?
So Governor Armstrong appointed him to this office, but he will have to run and then be chosen by North Dakotans to finish the term that Baszler was elected to last year. So he'll have to run in 2026, and if he still wants that job after that, he'll have to run again in 2028.
So between running to every school district in the state and running for office, that's a lot of running, but as a track coach, I bet he's trained up pretty well for that. So, running superintendent. Now, Danielle, one thing going back to the Federal Department of Education. Just last week, the Office of Special Education Programs at the department was closed down. Now, I think a lot of parents of kids with varying educational needs, and I have to say I have one. I have a child who has special needs, and so this is of particular interest to me. We have to have concerns about this. Does this new superintendent have any ideas, plans, anything for going forward without that federal support for special ed?
That's a great question. And he was asked about that at the news conference where Armstrong named him as superintendent.
We have an opportunity. When we say all kids, we have to really mean all kids. And so I'm excited to work not only with the folks in the special education office, but all the offices. It's not only going to take all the offices in DPI, it's going to take parents, it's going to take schools, it's going to take students working together.
All right, certainly a lot of moving parts in this changing landscape, although not moving fast enough during the times of closed government, really. A lot to be watching for sure and paying attention to. Thanks for that, Danielle. So what else has the Prairie Public Newsroom been reporting on this week?
They're expected to have the same learning outcomes, the same grading scales, and the same course length as a college student taking that same course.
In other education news, more than 6,000 North Dakota high schoolers currently take dual credit courses, classes in high school that also count toward their college degrees.
There's always the human involvement and double checking that.
North Dakota Legislative Council is trying out AI to summarize bills.
It's 57,000 North Dakotans. It's a big deal.
And in more shutdown news, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, will run out of funds on November 1st. Governor Armstrong is working with state agencies on a response.
Well, we'll keep waiting for the news cycle to slow down and let us breathe just a little bit, Danielle. I guess we'll be waiting a century or two. Thanks for all that.
You bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news stories and check out our online newsroom at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Prairie Beats. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
That was an episode of our weekly news regional podcast, Prairie Beat. You can subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts and listen for new episodes every Wednesday.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 22nd. The North Dakota State Archives houses a collection of papers compiled by local WPA workers during the 1930s. These include a variety of interviews and gathered information about people, places, and more, all related to North Dakota. One portion of the series documents the histories of cities, townships, and counties told through historical sketches and interviews that share different lived experiences. Along with learning about the places we call home, these records also include stories that narrators didn't want to share publicly at the time. Many revolve around hearsay, gossip, and juicy tidbits about towns, people, or groups. One story claimed that a grocery store near New Salem practically always cheated the settlers. The narrator said it was the only store in town, so everyone had to sell their fresh butter there. The store owner would claim the butter wasn't fresh to lower the price, and then resell it as fresh. Or he simply wouldn't pay full price. Another account from around Dickinson alleged that key testimony was left out of a coroner's inquest into a death. A posse had chased a man who was then killed by gunfire. But two people claimed that of the 30 shots fired, 29 went into the man's horse. Only one bullet hit the man, entering through his back and piercing his heart. They claimed only one person fired that fatal shot and that he did it on purpose. He wasn't just part of the posse. He was also considered one of the best marksmen in the area. And in Williston, a more comical story came from the town's first librarian. She said, and we quote, "It took her several years to make the people of Williston conscious that the library was theirs and not just for the Women's Civic League. She considered her victory complete when she got the Book and Thimble Club bitter rivals of the Civic League to start using the library after 3 or 4 years. Today, these stories may seem interesting, sad, or even a little funny. But even material like this helps paint a picture of early life in North Dakota and provides valuable historical context and insight. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Fargo Public Library presents their Fall Into Jazz concerts featuring local jazz artists Saturdays, October 4th through the 25th, starting at 4 p.m. at the Downtown Main Library. More information at fargolibrary.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We are at an inflection point when it comes to journalism, a fork in the road, if you will. We could head down the path to where only a few agenda-driven companies control the flow of information. Or we could energize the reliable sources for fact-driven, unbiased, uninfluenced news. One of those dependable sources is public radio. While trusted publications often require a paid subscription, public radio's over-the-air and digitally on-demand service is free for everyone. We rely on voluntary donations from our listeners to share in the costs. In North Dakota, public radio means Prairie Public. So please support the excellent regional coverage and the global and national reporting here at NPR. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the Donate tab.
You might hear some people you agree with on Morning Edition and some you don't. That's the point. Different views for a full picture of the news. Listen weekdays from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on Main Street, State Tourism Director Sarah Audie Coleman shares how 2026 will put North Dakota in the global spotlight, from National Geographic's Best of the World honor for the Badlands to the grand opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Medora. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.